So today I'm going to talk to you about, this is very loud. Sounds very loud. Today I'm going to talk to you about experiments that could be useful to detect, to test fundamental physics that are based on a very simple idea. So if you mechanically suspend an object, that object, it's in a constant thermal and vibrational contact with its environment, So that means that that object is automatically more prone to sources of noise. Back in the 70s, a group led by Ashkin in Bell Labs said, okay, let's eliminate the mechanical suspension and let's suspend the object with light. Now, what they've managed to do this way, they've managed to eliminate a lot of noise, and at the same time, they created a designer oscillator. So if this object is dielectric, then you expect the force that's applied on it by the light to be of the form, to be proportional to the gradient of the electric field squared. So if you expand around an extremum of the intensity, you find that that force small displacement around that extremum, you find that that force looks like a harmonic oscillator force. So what you have created is a very well-isolated designer cantilever, in a sense. So these systems, the quality factors, the frequency over the loss rate, can be larger than 10 to the 12. Just to give you an idea of how important this is, if you look at ordinary cantilevers, mechanical cantilevers, the best they can be is like, a, you can get is quality factors of, order, of something like 10 to the 6. So this is a 6 order of magnitude improvement. At the same time, you've managed to decouple the vibrational modes of the object. If you look at for small size objects, now I'm going to be talking about roughly a few hundred nanometers in size objects, and for those, the vibrational internal mode frequency is at the gigahertz range. The trapping frequencies I'm going to be talking about are of the order of megahertz and below. So you've managed to also isolate yourself from the center of mass motion from the internal degrees of freedom. And then, because now you're holding with the object with light, and you have very control of light, given that our laser technology is so good, we can control the center of mass motion very well, and we can actually tune the trapping frequency of the center of mass motion to what we want. This simple idea can be applied to all types of things. Can be applied to atoms, molecules, or even macroscopic objects. So this idea has actually led, this work of Ashkin has actually led to the entire field of atom interferometry, of trapping and cooling and manipulating atoms. Optical tweezers, as they're otherwise known, are also used in biology to manipulate proteins. And in the past few years, there's been a great push to use these techniques to manipulate macroscopic objects of the size of 100 nanometers or larger. The primary goal is to use it in quantum computing. And to this end, there has been great improvement in the past decade. So this is a plot that shows the minimum excitation energy in the trap of the center of mass motion that they have achieved in terms of the thermal quanta that the trapped object has as a function of the oscillator frequency, of the trapping frequency. And as you can see, as the frequency increases and as well also as time passes by, people have been reducing the amount of thermal quanta that they can, that this oscillator has in its trap, and with the culmination of this Cleland experiment in 2010, where they've managed actually to cool an object that has roughly 10 to the 9 atoms down to this ground state of motion. So this object is actually a very small cantilever. You can see it here, it's roughly 60 microns wide. And they've actually managed to couple it to a squid, and they've measured the coherent oscillation of this of the state of this oscillator going from the ground to the first excited state and back. One of the main techniques that's been very crucial to this progress is optical cooling, which is also known as Doppler cooling. And in order to understand how it works for macroscopic objects, it's good to start on how it works with atoms. So imagine now that you have a laser that's shown on an atom, and the laser frequency is less than the resonant excitation frequency of the atom. When the atom is moving it's counter-propagating with the laser, it's propagating towards the laser, the atom will see the frequency of the laser Doppler shifted so it can absorb it, and it will find itself in an excited state while having absorbed the photon. Later on, if you wait a while, the atom will go back to its ground state. Now it will emit the same photon at the resonant frequency of the atom. So it will have emitted a higher energy photon that it has absorbed. So the overall center of mass kinetic energy has decreased. And this leads to a cooling of the motion of the atom and to essentially a drag force that's proportional to the velocity. Analogously, if you have, let's imagine now that you have a macroscopic dielectric object trapped in a cavity. Here, the resonant frequency is set by the resonant frequency of the cavity. Now, let's imagine that we shine in the cavity a laser that has frequency slightly less than the resonant frequency of the cavity. Now, our quantum oscillator, can absorb one of the photons, and in order to be able to do so, it has to decrease its thermal quanta by one. Later on, the same object will re-emit that photon. Now, this is stimulated emission. It will re-emit the photon at the resonant frequency of the cavity. So again, our object has emitted a photon of energy larger than what it has absorbed. So it finds itself at smaller kinetic energy. It has less kinetic energy in its trap. So this is how you manage to cool. This again causes a friction term. Light, laser light, reticulated light can cause a friction term in the cavity, and this is what manages to cool. You have great control at cooling the motion of the object in the trap. So using these techniques, I will describe how you can use these very sensitive techniques to do short distance tests of gravity of Newton's law. Then I will discuss how you can detect gravitational waves at high frequencies, above 10 kilohertz. And then I'll do a small parenthesis to describe what type of sources of gravitational waves you should expect at those high frequencies. And then at the end, I will discuss on possible future directions of how you could imagine using these techniques to create macroscopic matter wave interferometers of macroscopic objects, of something that's that has 10 to the 9 atoms. So for the short distance test of gravity, there are several theories actually that predict that Newton's law should be modified at distances of around a millimeter. These can be theories of large extra dimensions, supersymmetry, or moduli, or the dilaton of string theory. In these experiments, what you do is you usually have a small cantilever. Let me take the hockey stick. A small cantilever who has a small test mass at the tip. Below the cantilever, you have another test mass that you drive to the resonant frequency of the cantilever. If there is a deviation from Newton's law, which is usually parametrized with the addition of a Yukawa force, that is, then you will see a difference in the change in the way this cantilever oscillates. The deviation from Newton's law are usually characterized by the strength of the force relative to gravity, alpha, and the range of the force, which is essentially the mass of the mediator particle. So these are the classical, these are the techniques that are used in groups like Capitulnis' group at Stanford, or similarly Adelberger's group. By using light instead to suspend your object, you can get much higher sensitivities. So here, what you do is you use a standing wave made out of light to trap a small dielectric object close to a surface. Behind the surface, you have a test mass that you oscillate. You oscillate a test mass to the resonant frequency of the trapped object. You have a question?
I was moving toward one.
Yeah.
How small is this dielectric mass compared to the filaments?
Ah, so this is actually much, it's a factor of 100 smaller. So these are roughly objects of 100 nanometers. What you want is the wavelength of light you usually use is roughly around a micron, and in order for the point particle approximation to be good, you want the size of the particle to be smaller than that number, so up to a few hundred nanometers. Exactly, that's the point. So you can improve a lot because you have a very dense object that you can bring much closer to the test mass. You can improve a lot the short distance test of gravity at submicron distances. So the sensitivity that you can get with these experiments is at the level of 10 to the minus 21 Newton per hertz. The current best cantilever experiments are at the level of 10 to the minus 18 Newtons per root hertz. So it's a 3 orders of magnitude improvement in force sensitivity. And the main way you can do this is because the sensitivity is proportional to the square root of the center of mass temperature motion over the quality factor. So this 10 to the 12 quality factor is what gives you a big gain. I have to say here, there is another, there are two lasers actually that are shown in the object. There is the second laser that is used to cool the object and at the same time also read out the position of the object to very high accuracy. So this is a plot that summarizes how well these experiments can do. So this is the force of the new force, the strength of the new force relative to gravity as a function of the range of the force mediator. And this is how well these are current bounds in yellow. And this is how well these experiments can do. And as you can see, you can have up to 10 to the 6 orders of magnitude improvement on current bounds at distances below a micron. So that brings you down to 10 to the 3 roughly times gravity at those distances.
So the yellow experiments
are the this is the Capitulnik experiment. And this is A and B. These are two different size of spheres. So this is, I think, a 150 nanometer size sphere, and this is a 50 nanometer size sphere. And the reason is, first of all, as you can see, the one that has 150 nanometers, because you are still sensitive to force, you have a larger mass, so you are also sensitive to larger force. But now, if you make the object smaller, you're sensitive to a bit more sensitive to shorter range forces if you make the object smaller. So my collaborator, the person that I wrote the following paper with, so he already wrote a paper in 2010, and he's gearing up to do this experiment. So he's building the cavity, so he's building this exact setup. When he will be done, experiment, I would say 5 years till you get results. But he's actually doing this. Yes?
So how did you quantify the sensitivity of the system?
So what you calculate is the force between the, so the way you calculate it is, you go back, you have to, this is a test mass, this is your object, you calculate how much additional force you get compared to gravity, calculating that you have some interaction and you put in this sensitivity, okay? And then what you do is you vary, you have to do control parameters, you vary the distance from the source and you vary the frequency of oscillation. So the moment you see a deviation at a C, so it's a bit subtle. I'm simplifying the way these experiments work. So notice that this is not a truly, it's not a perfect system. So when you do a Fourier decomposition of the force, it will have perfect harmonics. If I start oscillating this mass at a given frequency, if I have just pure gravity, it would have certain harmonics. It would appear at a frequency, let's say, of 30 kilohertz and one other at 60 kilohertz, etc. If I, in addition to this, I have a Yukawa force, I can design this experiment so that I get excitations at frequencies where I shouldn't expect, like at 45 kilohertz. So I tune the frequency of this object to be at the position where I should not expect any signal if I have just gravity. If I have this extra force that can be at this level, I would get some vibration, some resonant enhancement of the signal, because this is a resonant detection of the signal. So by doing that, you go back and you build this plot as a function of the distance. So you can get a great improvement at below submicron scales. Now there is another way these setups can be useful, and this is gravitational wave detection. Gravitational waves are the last piece of general relativity that we have not observed directly. We have to observe them indirectly by observing neutron stars. We expect them to be tons of them around and at different frequencies from astrophysics coming from in spirals of black holes and massive objects. And we also expect several beyond the standard model's sources. For example, inflation, phase transitions, etc. So what I'm going to be talking about is how you can use these very sensitive techniques to detect gravitational waves at frequencies above 10 kilohertz. So in this setup, you have a cavity of size L, which is in what I'm going to be considering will be ranging anywhere from 10 to 100 meters. In this cavity, I trap an object, a sensor, what I will call a sensor, which can either be a sphere of roughly 150 nanometers in radius, or a disk that has 500 nanometers thickness and a radius of 75 microns. And there is a very powerful laser that used to hold this object. And there is also a laser that measures, cools the center of mass motion at the same, and another one that measures the position of the sphere to very high accuracy. So when a gravity wave passes through the setup, what it will do, it will change all distances perpendicular to the direction of propagation. Here, if the gravity waves come in this direction, it will start changing the distance between the mirrors. So in order to understand the effect, so a gravitational wave changes the physical distance between masses. So in order to see what the effect on the setup would be, we have to take both into account the effect of the gravitational wave on both mirrors, as well as the sphere. So, and we have to see how now the minimum of the trap changes with respect to the position of the sphere. So first, the first thing the gravitational wave will do, it will change the physical distance between the two mirrors.
The mirrors are hanging by gravity.
Yes. So you can do the same. Let's ignore gravity for a minute. Let's assume that they're in free space, but gravity does not change this picture. So what it will do, it will shift the minimum, this antinode by an amount that's proportional to half the size of the length of the cavity times the amplitude of the gravitational wave. The gravitational wave will also shift the physical distance between the input mirror where I shine the laser from and the sphere. And that amount again will be proportional to the amplitude of the gravitational wave times the distance of where I put this sphere or sensor from the input mirror. And of course, because I'm measuring the position of this of this sensor with respect to its minimum, what I care about is the difference between the two quantities. So how much the sphere has shifted from its minimum. Now, if the frequency of the gravity wave matches the frequency of the trapping frequency, I will have a resonant enhancement of this oscillation. And this is the signal that I will be detecting. And because now the frequency, the trapping frequency of the sensor is set by the intensity of the laser, I have a tunable gravitational wave detector. So I can tune, I can scan different frequencies to do the resonance. It's like a tunable bar detector in a sense. And for a 100 meter cavity, if you use a disk, you can get sensitivities that are at the level of 10 to the minus 22 per root hertz, which is at least comparable to LIGO at those frequencies. And the main, I should say here, that the main background in this experiment is not limitations due to laser throat noise, but it's the motion of the object in the trap itself. And this is a plot that shows the sensitivity in gravitational wave detection in more detail. So this is the sensitivity in H, in the amplitude of a gravitational wave, as a function of frequency. This blue line up here is for a sphere that has a size of 150 nanometers. And the lines below it are for a disk or 50 that has a size, a width of 500 nanometers and a radius of 75 microns. The large improvement in sensitivity is twofold. First of all, because the disk has a huge mass, so any motion that coming from thermal noise is reduced, like the square root of the mass. And at the same time, because of the disk geometry, the scattering of light that will cause a thermal motion that increase the thermal motion of the object in the trap is actually reduced for a disk versus a sphere.
Sorry.
Yes?
You're going to have to suspend the system, right?
This does not may not have to be suspended. The way this is suspended is from the intensity of the laser itself. So the laser may be strong enough to hold this object. So you hold the mirrors, but you may not have to hold this object. Because the intensity of the laser, you can think of the laser beam, the waist of the laser, has a gradient also in this direction. So it may be strong enough to hold against gravity. So you don't have to attach it to anything.
But so your analysis of this of the gravitational wave effect on the minima assumes that the reflectors are fixed, or I thought they were in free fall.
No, they're in free fall because you're assuming there's some the suspension. Imagine that the suspension is the same as LIGO. You require some very soft suspension so that they are almost essentially in free fall. They can move around with the gravitational.
Okay. So you also have to worry about the suspension.
Yes, but only for the mirrors at the end mirrors of the cavity,
right.
Not from the object itself.
Right.
Yeah. But the thing is that at those high frequencies, that's not a problem because the vibrational noise actually dominates even at LIGO. If you look at LIGO, it only dominates at low frequencies. And it drops like the frequency squared at these high frequencies. So for the sensitivities that I'm talking about, it's no, even if you use a relatively crappy suspension system, you'll be doing very well. So it doesn't have to be very sensitive. Like, it doesn't have to be as sophisticated as the one they're using in advanced LIGO.
Actually, I was more worried about the modes of the stuff you use to suspend the system. Not
what do you mean?
So you have to worry about seismic noise?
Seismic noise, is, as I said, is active at low frequency.
But then you're using something to suspend the system, and that's something also has vibration modes.
Yes, that can also be controlled to below this level. The point is that you can think about it this way. The example you can use, the reference example you can use is LIGO. There, the resonant frequency of the suspension is at around a hertz. The moment you go above the resonant frequency of your suspension, any noise is not enhanced. It drops like 1/f². So this is where you gain. So at these frequencies, seismic vibrational noise is not a problem. The main source here of noise is because of the motion of your sensor, the things that you use. In LIGO, what they use, the sensors are the mirrors themselves. This is what you use to detect gravitational waves. Here, what you observe is a resonantly enhanced motion of a very small object. Sorry. And that is what, this is where the main source of noise may come in. And this is how, now, these experiments compare to LIGO. So the solid red curve is the current LIGO curve, and the dotted curve, this dotted red curve, is what is expected projected for advanced LIGO. These resonant peaks here that you see are what is called the free spectral range regime for LIGO, and this is where the frequency of the period of the gravitational wave matches the round trip time of the photons in the mirror. So you have a resonant enhancement of the signal. The overall shape of the overall shape of this curve, you can see the sensitivity drops like the frequency gets worse, like the frequency, and this is due to two things. First of all, there is at these high frequencies, LIGO is limited by shot noise, laser shot noise, and by the response of the LIGO detector itself to the gravitational wave. Because now at those high frequencies, the wavelength of the gravitational wave becomes smaller than the size of LIGO. So so there is time delay effects. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think these are actually they are at the level of 10^-21. I think they're either comparable or slightly worse. I don't think there are any. There are proposals that suggest going to 10^-21. I think they also may be slightly smaller frequencies than that. So this is superconducting cavities. I know the ones that have built right now is at 10^-19. Yes? Yeah, so there is two cavities, the two superconducting cavities, and they have some mechanical coupling between, and they look at how, if you match the frequency of the mechanical oscillator in the middle, you have a transmission of power to the other cavity, right? So these are, I think, how they work. And those, yeah, so the ones that I looked at, I think the ones that are designed to work right now are at the level of 10^-19. Are some, they are at lower frequencies. The reason is that the frequency, the resonant frequency, is set by the frequency of the mechanical coupling between the two cavities. So yeah, so they are not as sensitive as this. And the other thing is that these are not tunable, right? Every time you need to detect the gravity, you need another frequency, you have to change your entire detector. Here you can change, by changing the intensity of the laser, you can scan all these frequencies with the same instrument. So as you can see here, that at around frequencies of around 60 kilohertz, these experiments become comparable to LIGO. An advanced LIGO, and at frequencies that are roughly 300 kilohertz, they become at least an order of magnitude better. So the search volume that they can look for is enhanced by a factor of 1,000. This may not be that impressive, but I have to remind you that LIGO is a 4 kilometer, has a 4 kilometer cavity, while the experiments that I'm talking about have a size that's 40 times smaller. This is a plot that summarizes the gravitational wave sensitivity of this setup compared to LIGO and the main sources of noise. So, as I've already told you, for this setup, the main source of noise is the thermal motion of the sensor in the trap, while for LIGO, it's the laser shot noise. The displacement sensitivity that you require is of the order of 10 to the minus 15, because you have resonant enhancement of the signal. You need to detect small distance to get a sensitivity at the level of 10 to the minus 22. You need to get roughly femtometer displacement sensitivity, while at LIGO, you need to get 3 times smaller sensitivity, factor of 1,000 smaller sensitivity. And also, finally, because the sensor has a width that's smaller than the wavelength that they used to observe it, you don't care so much about the internal vibrational modes. It acts as a refractive object, so those modes do not contribute to the noise. While for LIGO, you have to worry about how light gets reflected from the surface. Vibrations of the surface could be perceived as center of mass motion for the LIGO mirrors. Yeah.
So why would you not use a cloud of 10 to 9 atoms instead of why are we using a solid object instead of, say, that? Like, what could you just use that cloud of atoms for the same purpose?
For the same purpose, you cannot detect that cloud of atoms to the sensitivity, to femtometer sensitivity. So, and also this object is much more diffuse, 10 to the 9 atoms. So it's too diffuse, it's centimeter in size. So while this, you have very concentrated, this is 150. This is a few hundred nanometers in width. So you have.
When you said that they were detecting the center of mass, that they put the center of mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what they were detecting.
They were detecting. This was a solid. This was a piece of solid. It wasn't. It was a piece of solid that had 10 to the 9 atoms in it. But they were. It was not a gas of atoms. It was a cantilever that had 10 to the 9 atoms. So now the question is, what sources should you expect at those frequencies, at above 10 kilohertz? Turns out that for astrophysical sources, there is a natural cutoff that's set by the smallest size object you can have in the universe that has strong gravity. And that's the minimum black hole size. And turns out that for solar mass black hole, this turns out to be roughly 30 kilohertz. So you don't expect to see that much at those frequencies coming from astrophysics. But I think that there's a very interesting source of gravitational waves that comes from beyond the standard model physics, in particular black hole superaddians. So this is a bit of a repeat of what you heard yesterday for some of you. This is an effect that's particular for rotating black holes. So rotating black holes have a region around them called the ergo region, where everything has to rotate, even light. So if you take an electromagnetic pulse that goes through that region, it will come out with higher amplitude than it came in. So during this process, you have extracted energy and angular momentum from the black hole. So you can repeat the process. You can imagine the following thought experiment, first proposed in the early 70s, where you take the black hole and you surround it by a perfectly spherical mirror. So if you do that, the same electromagnetic wave will have multiple reflections. Each time its amplitude enhanced, and as a result, the amplitude will be exponentially growing. At some point, the radiation pressure will be so big that it will make the mirror explode. Of course, this thought experiment is very, even though it's very cute, it's not very realistic, but turns out that massive particles, in particular massive bosons, can create their own mirror by having a bound state with a black hole. And in that case, the massive boson will bound itself with a black hole, and it will create, and then due to the superabundance effect, you will create a cloud of massive particles around the black hole, all sitting in the same state, and the black hole will lose spin and mass. The effect becomes larger when the Compton wavelength of the particle matches the black hole size. I think the most accurate description of this object is like a gravitational atom in the sky. So unless you sit very close to the black hole, very close to the horizon, the potential you see is a Newtonian potential. So it's a 1/r potential. So the way you can characterize state, again, is by a fine structure constant, an analogy with a hydrogen atom, that's set by the product of Newton's constant, the black hole mass, and the mass of your massive boson, so this G Newton times in black hole is the gravitational radius of the black hole. It has a binding energy that's of the same, it's given by the same formula as the hydrogen atom. It's given by the fine structure constant squared times the mass of the massive boson over 2n squared, where n is the principal quantum number. So you can characterize fully the state by the principal, the orbital, and the magnetic quantum numbers. But there is a big and very important difference compared to the hydrogen atom. And the fact that, and this is the fact that instead of fermions occupying the levels of this atom, you have bosons. So in order for this, if you calculate how many bosons you have in this state surrounding the black hole, you find that you can have 10 to the 75 bosons or more. Of course, not all levels are superradiating. So in order for a level to superradiate, it has to satisfy the superradiance condition. That condition requires that the total energy of your boson is less than the magnetic quantum number of that particular state that you look at times the angular velocity of the black hole. The angular velocity of the black hole. So this is a very... So the angular velocity of the black hole, roughly this omega plus, is given by this formula. A is the spin, the black hole spin, that can vary from 0 to 1. And you can understand this in terms of the particle picture very easily if you think about the following experiment. So if you have a rotating cylinder, and if you scatter tangentially from the surface of the cylinder a small object, and you want that object to come out with higher velocity than it came in, you have to send it in with a velocity that's smaller than the rotational angular velocity of the cylinder. So that's the condition. So here you can translate, you can actually find, by rewriting what the binding energy is, you can actually find that this tells you that the velocity of the bosons in the bound state has to be less than 1/2. So it tells you that it has to be at less than relativistic. The rate of this process is determined by the gravitation of the infall time, the gravitational radius of the black hole, and can be at best 10 to the 7 times the infall time. For a solar mass black hole, this time, this is roughly 100 seconds. And if you compare it to the dynamical scale of evolution for black holes, which is the Eddington accretion rate, which is 10 to the 8 years, you know that you have plenty of time for this effect to be relevant for the black holes that are here in our universe. Particularly if you make the particle very light, if the Compton wavelength of the particle becomes much larger than the black hole size, then you find that this time scale varies with a high power of this, the product of the mass times the gravitational radius of the black hole. And if the mass becomes very heavy of the particle, then you transition to the classical regime, and then the time scale is exponentially suppressed, becomes exponentially large. So the question is, for astrophysical black holes, what are good particles to have around? Are there any well-motivated particles? And turns out there is at least one that's motivated by the problem of the strong CP problem in QCD. In the standard model, using Lagrangian, you can add this term that's parameterized by this angle. And this term will induce a non-zero dipole moment for the neutron. Of course, we've looked for this dipole moment, and we know that actually it's not there, and this angle, theta QCD, is bound to be less than 10 to the minus 10. So we need a solution. So in order to solve this problem, we promote this angle to a dynamical field, what is known as the axion, whose mass is given by, whose mass is generated by non-perturbative QCD effects. And turns out that it gives rise, and its properties are also determined by the axion decay constant. And turns out that if you have an axion decay constant around 10 to 70 GeV, you get a Compton wavelength of 3 kilometers, which is roughly the size of astrophysical solar mass black holes. So the QCD axion can affect the evolution of solar mass black holes. So in order to understand how the evolution works, first of all, you have to look how superradiance evolves for astrophysical black holes. First of all, you have to look at how fast the superradiance stability grows. Then you have to compare it with the dynamical evolution timescale for black holes, which is not a problem because this timescale is very long, 10 to the 8 years. You also have to think about what happens with axion self-interactions, which are actually stronger than gravity and can come in the evolution of black hole. And the other thing is that because we're talking about the gravitational atom in the sky, you get also gravitational waves coming from transitions of these axions between different levels of this atom. And this is a source of monochromatic gravitational wave radiation. Another source of monochromatic gravitational wave radiation is axion annihilations. So in this case, axions are their own antiparticles. So in the cloud, they can annihilate one graviton, while the bound state, the black hole, makes sure energy and momentum are conserved. So the first thing you should observe in this case is the absence of fastly rotating black holes. So if you were to measure spin versus mass of black holes, you should see if you have an axion whose Compton wavelength matches the black hole size, you shouldn't be able to observe fastly rotating black holes in that region. So you should be able to see only black holes that are below the black line. But this curve is actually oversimplified. So if you look more closely, you'll see that you have different curves. You have a different curve for any level that can superradiate. So this is the orbital angular momentum 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 8 for different colors. And now I've shifted. So this is no longer a log scale. This is spin versus mass. And this is now for solar mass black hole. And the maximum superradiance rate happens for the level that has the minimum orbital and the maximum magnetic quantum number that can superradiate. So let's start with, we can start with a black hole that's fastly rotating from birth. And in this case, the level that should be superradiating is the L equals 2 level. So this level, in this level, we create an instability. A cloud of axions will start growing around the black hole. And you will need roughly 100 defaults till that cloud has extracted enough angular momentum from the black hole. In that case, the cloud, the mass of the cloud is roughly 1 to 10% of the black hole mass. After that, that cloud, at some point, that cloud no longer satisfies, that level no longer satisfies the superradiance condition because you have reduced the spin of the black hole. And then you have to wait for the next level to start superradiating. And then so forth. So now the black hole would have been jumping in this plot downwards. Till at some point, you'll reach the level for which the evolution timescale for superradiance is longer than the dynamical evolution timescale for the black hole. And then the effect will stop. One thing that needs to be taken into account and leads to a very spectacular effect is the effect of self-interactions. So when the self-interaction energy of the axis of the bound bosons in the trap becomes of order, the binding energy, if the interaction is attractive, you expect the cloud to collapse under its self-interactions. And you will get an effect that people that work on Bose-Einstein condensates have observed it in the lab many times, and it's called the Bosanova. You'll get an explosion where the cloud collapses under its own attractive forces, one order one fraction of it falls back into the black hole, and another fraction of it flies away. This happens, when this happens depends on essentially the relative strength of the self-interaction compared to gravity. And for the QCD action that's roughly around the gut scale, this happens when the actual cloud mass is at around the level of 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. So in order now to extract order one spin from the black hole, you have to repeat the Bosanova process by 10 to 100 times. So this actually is a process that slows down the superradiance. So now, in order for a certain level to stop superradiating, you have to wait, instead of 100 defaults, you have to wait from 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 4. So actually, self-interactions can impede, if they are too strong, they can actually impede the superradiance process for a certain particle. So the great thing is that, so what I've been showing you so far is the superradiance, what the superradiant curve would look like for a particular particle, for an axion that has a mass of 10 to the minus 11 eV. And if you can translate this to what it means for the QCD axion, it means for a QCD constant of 10 to the 17 GeV. So they're actually, yeah?
Would you expect such axions to completely dominate the mass of the universe?
Oh, no, that's not a problem. And I'll tell you why. I don't consider that a problem because of several reasons. You can think about it as you want. So if you calculate actually what the initial displacement of the, how far away you have to tune, it's not 1 per mil, it's like 3%. So you, instead of the initial displacement of the axion for an axion that has gut scale, an axion decay constant of m gut, is like instead of order one, it has to be 0.03.
This is 10 to the 17.
The other thing is that, so it depends on how much tuning. The other thing is that I think inflation provides you for a way to naturally scan the action parameter space. So if you have enough phi folds, let's assume that the phase is above the scale of inflation, then the action will be random walking during inflation. So then you will scan automatically all parameters. So inflation itself gives you a landscape for which you can scan the axion abundance. And then you'll find yourself in the region in that value of axion that does not overclose the universe. So I don't think that's a problem.
Wait, if you scan it,
yes,
you will find yourself most often in regions where the axion overcloses.
No, you won't, because you won't be there. You won't be able to form the universe.
We are not being killed by axions right now.
Exactly. But the point is that there is an anthropic. So if you had too many axions in the universe,
yeah,
you wouldn't be able to form galaxies. Because of inflation, you have a bound on how much dark matter and baryonic matter you have, right? Omega has to be close to, you have to have critical close. You have to, because of inflation, you have to be very close to critical density.
That's actually not true. Inflation allows an open universe very easily.
But you can have, the point is that there is a bar. If you have too much dark matter, baryons cannot cool. You won't be able to form galactic disks. So there's an anthropic bound on how much dark matter you have. So I don't think that in the presence of the landscape, or if you have enough e-folds in inflation, this is a serious bound. So I don't think that this constrains enough the action parameter space.
Let's discuss it afterwards, because I strongly disagree.
Okay.
I know this is the folklore, but I think it's wishful thinking.
Okay, I'll be happy to discuss it afterwards. Okay. Good. Yes, someone else had a question?
I was going to ask, many of you, I think you're going to get it, actually.
pace yourself, you're getting to the gravitational part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So so if you look now at data that measures spin versus mass of black holes, you see that that actual data plays a bound on the action decay constant, and that's an upper bound on the action decay constant. It tells you that the action decay constant has to be less than 10 to the 17 GeV, and this is a regime where there are currently no experiments that can detect the QCD action. And also for this bound, you require no prior cosmic abundance for the action. Even if you have zero actions in our universe, as long as the actions in this theory, superactions will make sure. It will still affect the evolution of astrophysical black holes.
Sorry, Nina?
Yes?
Is this supposed to be the curve for an excluded F? Because I don't see any crosses.
No, no, this is the bound.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is right at the bound.
Right at the bound. Yeah, that's why. That's why they are all... that's why all the points are on the right, because it's right at the boundary. It's not excluded. So this is where the current bound is. So if you were to observe actually lower mass black holes in this region, you will be able to probe axions down to an MFA of 10 to the 16 GeV. So what is the signal that will be detected by this experiment? So it turns out that if you look at axion annihilations, the frequency of the gravitational waves you should expect is at around 100 kilohertz for the QCD axion, if it's a decay constant close to the gut scale. The size of the signal you expect is at around 10 to the minus 19, if the black hole that has the cloud around it is roughly within 10 kiloparsec from us, and it has a mass of roughly two solar masses, has a mass of order solar mass. The signal duration can last for several years. And this is how now it shows on the sensitivity plot. So this blue line is an upper bound, this bright blue line is an upper bound on how big the signal coming from QCD action superaddions can be. And this is where the gut scale QCD action lies. I'm not plotting anything below here because this is already excluded by superaddions observation. So you can see that this experiment will be sensitive to this signal, and you can also see that even advanced LIGO will have some sensitivity at high FA axions, axions that are closer to 10 kilohertz, gives frequency closer to 10 kilohertz. Yes?
I was going to ask you, so at this
yeah.
Where you saturate the upper bound on the signal. Is the spin down rate there much less than the spin up rate you would agree?
This is where the cloud, I'm assuming the cloud is maximum, so superaddions are stopped. So it doesn't have to be superaddiating at the time. So the cloud can be the cloud can have formed, taking out some of the spin of the black hole, and it just sits there. This is what it happens.
It could have formed 10 billion years ago, and then now it's just
not 10 billion years ago. 10 billion years ago, it would have probably annihilated away, but in the past few thousands of years or something like that, it depends a lot on the parameters. So yes, it has to be relatively recent, but not that recent. Yes, but the point is though, so yes, that's true, you have to be a bit lucky for this signal. So, but the thing is that you have to keep in mind that 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9 black holes in our galaxy, and I think actually the most promising signal for action superaddions is the one coming from transitions. Because these transitions can last, they give a higher signal, they are not as suppressed. The point is that these annihilations are relatively suppressed. Because this is it has to be a relativistic effect, and the axions in the cloud are actually a bit non-relativistic. So you're suppressed by high powers of the velocity. So it's a relatively small rate. That's why you can only be sensitive to things that are within our galaxy. If for transitions between different levels, you can see anything that within probably within our local cluster. So distances of 10 megaparsec, of order of 10 megaparsec. And that's and actually the frequency for that is lower. It comes out to be at 100 hertz for the QCD axiom.
Just a question. So in the previous slide,
you
have this epsilon 10 minus 3.
Yeah.
That's something you assume, right? Is this epsilon the mass of the cloud?
Yeah, this is the mass of the cloud. This is what I assume, yes.
I see.
So it's an upper bound of what it can be. This is what I'm taking. Because I think, in principle, if you ignore self-interactions, this can be larger. But this is actually kind of limited if self-interactions are present. And for a gut scale action, this is roughly the size of the cloud you can possibly have. If self-interactions are not present, this number can be of order 10%. At that point, of course, nonlinear effects of our gravity would be important. So then you have to worry about those. So to summarize,
Can I ask one other question?
Yeah.
So this annihilation signal, so each annihilation increases the graviton, they're all producing basically the same frequency.
Yes.
But do they form, are the gravitons coherent? Or
yes.
Do you
because all the axions are on the same state. So it's a Bose-Einstein condition with all the particles on the same state. So actually the reason why the signal is so large, because you get resonant enhancement, you get an enhancement of the signal. So the signal rate is enhanced by n squared. So this is what saves you. Otherwise, you get some crazy suppression because of you have very high velocity power suppression. Yes?
Have you found the classical solution for the axion in the presence of the spinning pole?
Yes. So there are analytical solutions. They've had the solutions for a while. What we did is because we care about how the wave function looks away from the ergo region, and there it looks like a hydrogen wave function. If you integrate out, because this is
literally the axion field?
Yeah. So we solve for the axion field, essentially. So when we did our estimates, we found we have the axion wave function, which we have approximated in this region with a hydrogen wave function. And from that, you can extrapolate what the signal will be. So this is what we use.
There's a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation.
Yes. So formally, there's a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation that has been known for many, many years.
So this is just a Klein-Gordon equation?
So the way you find the solutions, okay. Formally, the way you find the solutions, you put a massive field, massive boson, in the presence of a Kerr black hole.
Yes.
So you solve essentially the Klein-Gordon and the Kerr background.
Yes.
And what you find is you find solutions that have imaginary parts. The energies have imaginary parts.
Are you doing linearized Klein-Gordon?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just saying one should find the solution. I mean, if there is a Bose-Einstein condensate, there should actually be a solution of the coupled equation.
Ah, of the coupled equations of the
yeah.
two.
Yeah.
The question is the stable solution. It's not obvious it's going to be a stable solution because these eigenvalues have imaginary.
If you say there is a Bose-Einstein condensate,
around
there is a steady state.
No. So steady state is an approximation, and I'll tell you why. Because there are always lower line levels that are non-superradiating, and you can transition to those through graviton emission, and then you will eventually decay. But the point is that rate is very slow compared to astrophysical timescale. So I'm ignoring that process. So in principle, it's steady state for my practical purposes. There are other processes that will, like the axion annihilation, that will come in and depopulate the cloud before the transition to lower levels that are non-superradiating and decay inside the black hole become relevant. By the way, it's very, I mean, you are doing this, right? So it's very important to look at non-linear effects of gravity on this system because the size of the cloud can be significant. I mean, here the self-interactions become more important before gravity, but for other fields, gravitational interactions will be important. So this is something that we have not done and you are doing, right?
Right. Well, it's also possible that gravitational emission saturates its instability before the cloud has had time to grow too much, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's something that needs to be looked at. So to summarize, you can use optical distract sensors in high frequency in large cavities to detect gravitational waves at sensitivities better than 10 to the minus 21 per root hertz at frequencies above, above 30 kilohertz roughly. They are smaller in size than LIGO. And in principle, you can imagine a have experience experiment that that's 40 times more. You use the entire LIGO arm, so you have an experiment that's 40 times more sensitive. And finally, you get improved sensitivity in a regime that's new for gravitational wave astronomy. So even though there may not be conventional astrophysical sources, it's like a new telescope you can use. So, well, I don't have enough time. So, but what I would like to say is that what we are looking at right now is the possibility of actually creating, cooling, we're examining the possibility of cooling these objects down to the ground state of motion, the trap. So we have a quantum center of mass motion for an object that has 10 to the 9 atoms. So the idea would be to actually create a macroscopic superposition of Schrödinger cat states for these objects. And in fact, there are several experiments to this end, the most known of which is the experiment done by Arndt's group in Vienna, where they've interfered, successfully interfered 430 atom organic molecule. In principle, with these techniques, we can imagine that we can do better, but I think I should stop here. It's 1 hour, so I think I should stop here. And say that these techniques can be potentially be a very useful tool in testing fundamental physics, and they already may be, and they already may be in the next few years, they may be probing short distance gravity in new regime, and the interesting thing would be to see how they can push quantum mechanics in a new in the macroscopic regime. Thank you. Yes?
So I always have this thing about this process. How do you know that the decay is coherent?
Huh?
How do you know that this decay to different states is coherent?
So the decay is coherent because all the actions are already in the same state. So what do you mean, how do I know it's coherent?
No, I can put everything in one state. It doesn't mean they all decay.
No, because it's a Lasing effect. The reason you have a classical field, the fact that you know when you solve the Klein-Gordon that you have a classical field that has this amplitude, automatically tells you that you have a Bose-Einstein condensate. So this state is coherent by construction. The black hole makes it coherent. All the actions are in the same state. The reason you get the exponential growth is exactly because you have this N enhancement. It's like it's like the way a laser is built in a crystal. You have a wave, you have stimulated emission of photons of a wave, and then you get the rate is enhanced by the number of photons in the pulse, and all have the same phase. Same thing happens here.
I think that is fine. Okay, that I can see even in the simulations. But my thing is, when they start transiting to a different state, so you see gravitational emission because there's decay to a different state.
Yes.
And I think you're saying that all these this transition happens also coherently.
Yes, because the rate is proportional to how many atoms you have in one state and how many atoms you have in the other state. So it also happens coherently. Why shouldn't it happen coherently? I don't see. I mean, it's exactly the same as laser. This is the fact that these are bosons gives you a lot of mileage. You get an enhanced rate.
Thank you.